When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The War Department in Washington is a beehive of activity. Day and night, people stride in and out, keeping the cogs of war in gear. One frequent visitor is President Abraham Lincoln, who often crosses alone from the White House, a short distance away. He arrives without ceremony, pushing through the throng gathered in the halls. The old library has been converted to a telegraph office. Here, all communications for the war have been centralized. Here, Lincoln can receive real-time information from the front and send his own strategic notions to his commander in the field, General George McClellan. In his dispatch today, April 6, 1862, Lincoln barely conceals his frustration. "You have now over 100,000 troops with you. I think you better break the enemy's line from Yorktown to Warwick River at once. This will probably use time as advantageously as you can." Here in the War Department, Abraham Lincoln, Commander-in-Chief, can be engaged directly in the war. A war that directly affects the lives of every single American, and which, for this moment at least, early in the war, is not going according to plan. Greetings, happy to have you along. This is American History Hit, and I'm Don Wildman. Few leaders in human history have faced challenges as daunting as those confronted by Abraham Lincoln as he assumed the office of the U.S. presidency in 1861. With his nation teetering on the brink of collapse, riven by deep-seated divisions over enslavement and states' rights, Lincoln would have to wage a war he didn't even want to fight. But the South's choice to pit itself against the North, to fire the first shots against a federal fort, ignited the conflict and drew the U.S. into a struggle for its very existence. After all, if the North lost, could it really go on calling itself the United States? It was a zero-sum game. We'd passed the point of no return. And to answer your questions and mine about this precipitous era, here is a friend of the show, Professor Adam Smith of the Rothermere American Institute at the University of Oxford, author of The Stormy Present: Conservatism and the Problem of Slavery in Northern Politics, 1846 to 1865. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Don.
We are talking today about the Civil War, Adam. Thank you for joining us. Let me start very generally. Lincoln at war. How much was this man even fit to lead a nation into military conflict of this scope?
Well, you wouldn't have thought he was fit at all. He had a little bit of experience fighting in the Black Hawk War. He said himself he spent most of his time just fighting mosquitoes. He had no formal military training. He had never seen war before. If the country had known they were going to be entering into this 4 years of extraordinary bloody conflict, then perhaps he would not have been selected as president. But he was the man in the spot, and in some ways was directly and indirectly responsible for the outbreak of war in the first place. And so to his desk came the decisions.
He states in his first inaugural address, right out of the gate, this is what it's all about. He even says, it stops you in your tracks when you read the speech. He basically says, I'm not going to talk about anything except this, because nobody cares about anything except this. It is his mission to preserve the Union above all else. How does he view secession? Tell me briefly how that works in his mind. It's a crime, right? The way he looks at it.
Secession is legally impossible. It's illegitimate. So Lincoln never recognized, either at the beginning of the war or right through to the end, he never recognized the legitimacy of the Confederacy. He never acknowledged that the United States was at war with another nation state or a polity of any kind. All he recognized legally was the existence of armed rebels, groups of people who were in armed rebellion against the United States. So his response was as if this was a riot in a city or analogous to Shays' Rebellion in 1780s Massachusetts or something. It was a big problem, but a problem that to which the only appropriate response was for the federal government to reassert its supremacy by force if necessary.
It's a real chess move, that inaugural address, because he basically says something that sounds kind of naive. At this point, seven states have seceded. I mean, they are well down the road towards civil war. And he gets up there and says, I don't want this. I'm not even going to take away, you know, the institution that we're arguing over. You can have it. We just need to get along and not be at war. In doing so, he's kind of setting the stage, isn't he? Because this is going to be your war, not ours. And thus it will spill forth from there.
Exactly. He's putting the ball in their court, and it's very skillful. He is saying, if war comes, it will be your choice, he's saying to the rebels, not ours. He has just, when he gives his first inaugural address, he has, of course, like all presidents, just sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So he simply says, well, I have to fulfill that oath. I will do my best to implement the laws, the federal laws across the whole Union. I will deliver the mails. I will not provoke you. I will not send troops immediately into your states. And certainly, as you imply there, Don, he certainly isn't going to remove slavery. I mean, he can't do that. The president can't do that. Congress can't do that. Supreme Court can't do that, even if they wanted to. So he's basically saying, look, you know, calm down, guys. The trouble is, by the time he gives this speech, as you say, not only have seven states seceded, the Deep South states, but they have formed a new Confederate government. So in a way, by then that
the horse has left the barn.
The horse has already bolted, yeah.
Lincoln would say that. How much did he know about the South's ability to fight this war? What was his intel?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think part of the answer here is that he didn't know very much. His intel was not very good. There is a persistent sense that Lincoln, he was by no means alone in this, had this enduring but in the end, misguided faith in an underlying Southern Unionism. It was almost as if he just couldn't quite believe that even at this point, even in March 1861, even after the swearing in of a provisional president, Jefferson Davis, even at that point, it's almost as if he couldn't believe they were serious about it. It's almost as if he was saying this is reacting as if they were simply game playing. He thought of himself sometimes as a Southerner, right? I mean, he was born in Kentucky. He obviously spent most of his adult life in Illinois, but he was married to a woman who had close connections with Kentucky and slaveholding. It wasn't as if he himself believed that he was of the South in some broad sense, even though he'd made his career in this new Republican Party, which defined itself not as anti-Southern, although it was often described in that way, but in a broad sense as anti-slavery. And so he felt that he was almost the spokesman for or wanted to connect with the broad swathe of non-slaveholding white folks in the South. And their underlying patriotism, he thought, would surely swell the chorus of the Union, to kind of go into a quotation from his inaugural address there, that he's appealing to their kind of, you know, the spirit of 1776.
How wrong he was. On the North side, he's getting his early advice from General Winfield Scott, a hero of the Mexican-American War, which had happened some time ago. This guy is 75 years old. The twist is that the president of the Confederacy is Jefferson Davis, who is an experienced and accomplished soldier from the Mexican-American War and had been Secretary of War under Franklin Pierce. I mean, it's all out of balance, like the country itself that is now divided.
Yes, if you looked at the two presidents, the president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, and the president of the new Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, and if the war had been determined purely on the basis of their past military experience and their prior preparation for their role, which obviously it wasn't, you would think that the Confederacy was surely going to win this war. I mean, Jefferson Davis knew what he was doing. As you say, he'd been formerly Secretary of War. He immediately begun, it wasn't solely responsible for this, of course, but the Confederacy was relatively extraordinarily successful, actually, in building up a war machine almost from scratch. Of course, not entirely from scratch, because they had all the state arsenals and the existing apparatus of state militias to. But Jefferson Davis had a plan, and he had a vision for how he was going to defend the independence of the new Confederacy. Whereas from the point of view of the Union, how they were going to mount a war effort to subdue an area, which especially after the secession of an additional four slave states was, you know, the size of Western Europe. You know, Napoleon hadn't managed to do it, right? I mean, how on earth was the federal government with virtually no standing army, with no real martial tradition, and led by a president with no military experience, how on earth were they going to do it?
Yep. I'm going to cite something that several times in this interview. If you like the way this man sounds, which I do, we did a previous episode I mentioned. You were a friend of the podcast, I say. Episode 143, for anyone keeping track, was called The Origins of the Civil War. And Adam and I talk about this. A lot of what goes into this period we cover in that previous conversation. So have a listen to that. We're more in the present day of the Civil War right now. So I want to talk about that. How does he raise an army? It used to be, until World War II, really, one of the points of pride for America, that we had no army between wars. It had to be raised up every single time. This was certainly the case back at the Civil War time. So where does Lincoln get his army?
He gets them via the state governors. I mean, as you say, this is a citizen army. Sometimes, you know, we refer in the Civil War to U.S. troops fighting for the Union. Strictly speaking, the United States troops were only those mustered into federal service, which were only ever a small minority of the troops enlisted in support of the Union. The great majority of Civil War soldiers were fighting, formally speaking, as it were, for their states, which is why, as I'm sure many listeners to your podcast know, they were listed as, you know, the 27th Pennsylvania, the 10th New York, and so on. So the state governors send out a call for volunteers after the firing on Fort Sumter, which you mentioned at the beginning, and Lincoln's call for troops. And in the early days, they're overwhelmed by volunteers. And the challenge is not finding men. The challenge is finding ammunitions and uniforms and finding people capable of drilling them and turning this kind of group of enthusiastic young men into proper soldiers.
It was, you know, commonly thought in those days that this war would be over in a matter of months, you know, 90 days or so, they thought. Did Lincoln share that view or not?
I think Lincoln certainly hoped that was true. I think there were plenty of people around him who knew that this was likely to be a longer conflict. But as you say, the initial call for troops was for 90-day volunteers for 3 months. So the idea was that it would all be over, not by Christmas, but by the end of the summer. And the assumption, the working assumption on both sides at the beginning of the war was that probably one big battle would determine the outcome, that the armies would train and gather, there would be one big confrontation, and everyone would be then able to go home.
The population of the North was 18.9 million people at that point. The South, 8.6. Okay, so we have more than twice the amount of people living in the North. The border states have 3.5 million. They're on the North side. So there's a lot of reasons to think, well, we just have all these people, you know, never mind the industry. Cash reserves, interesting little obscure fact I looked up. North had $234 million in cash reserves, South $74 million, the border $29 million. So we're close to $300 million in those days. That's a lot of money. And so one can understand why you would have this attitude.
Yeah, and you can add to that that the North had almost all of the industrial capacity. It had almost all the munitions factories, the railroad mileage, the credit, the financial houses. They unquestionably had a lot of advantages. They, of course, had control of the federal government for what that was worth, obviously a much smaller operation in those days than it was later to become. Those were the reasons why, if you were a supporter of the Union, you could be optimistic in 1861 about a quick victory. On the other hand, I've already said, you know, the challenge, if the South fought and if the South resisted, and by South in this context, I mean the White South, if the White South resisted, then how was the North, however many people they had, going to mobilize a military machine capable of subduing a population of that size over so big an area? Of course, the Southerners, precedent that they liked to cite was the American Revolution, which looked very similar from their point of view. It was a successful resistance to a military force that had been sent away from their home country, fighting in unfamiliar terrain against people who were literally fighting for home and hearth. And that was what the Southerners had on their side.
I learned something about building an army in these days, and Lincoln would participate in this, the idea of political generals versus military ones. I never understood even the term political generals.
There were, of course, the United States had West Point, and there were properly trained West Point generals, and a bunch of them resigned, and when their state seceded and joined the Confederate Army, but a number of them remained, and they became important leaders in the end, and General Grant was one of them, of course. But there were simply far more officer positions available than the old trained army could staff. And furthermore, the governors had political debts to pay. And people, since these were citizen armies, and since there was a long-standing, you've already said this, Don, a long-standing kind of suspicion of standing armies and of what was called derisively strategy, sort of implying that this was something sort of nefarious and that real battles were won through sort of manliness and bayonet charges head on into the enemy, and that strategy and digging in and all these kinds of things were somehow not what proper Republican citizens would do. All of this suggested that a good Republican, you know, small r Republican leader should be just as capable of leading men into battle in defense of the Republic as somebody who'd been trained in fancy French military theory at West Point. So the political generals that we talk about, and some of them were relatively successful and some of them were disasters, but there was a way for, it was yet another way for Lincoln as the president and state governors as well to distribute patronage, to try to build a coalition across parties. People, prominent political figures who wanted the military glory, would bring with them followers and supportive editorial coverage in newspapers and could attract volunteers to their banner. So there were lots of logistical and practical reasons why you wanted to have political generals in place.
It also had to do with ethnicities. The fact that we had such a large immigrant population, especially German and Irish, who were being called upon to join this army for a war they didn't have any part in. So one of the tricks of that was to get these political generals who were of that ethnicity to put out the rallying call. And suddenly you had an Irish general out of nowhere.
You had an Irish brigade and a German division and so on. You did. And that was an example of the larger phenomenon, which is this community-based volunteering. So, you know, beneath that, you had towns and communities and cities that would form their own regiments and that would, as it were, march to war together as brothers who'd grown up together, as friends, as neighbors who'd grown up together. And so it was natural, as it were, that the community of Irish immigrants in New York City or in Philadelphia or Boston would also go and join together and go and join up together when they did join up. And they would fight in a unit that then assumed that identity.
Lincoln was rumored in those first months after Declaration of War, rumored to be forging a compromise with the South. He felt the pressure to act. First Bull Run, Manassas, depending on where you come from, was that first battle, July 21st, 1861. Listeners, we are not going down a laundry list of battle scenes here. This is only a half-hour podcast, so we can only cover so much. But I do want to talk about Bull Run and the lesson of that time, for Lincoln especially. So this was known as the picnic battle, wasn't it? I mean, people went out from Washington. This is Centerville, around Centerville, which today is around Dulles International Airport. And it was less than a day's drive that you could go out and watch this battle. And they did.
Right. Yes, indeed. And with, you know, picnic campers and so on, as you said, and ladies and elderly gentlemen went out. And when the Confederates routed Union forces at Bull Run, there was this hell-for-leather panicked retreat, including civilians as well as uniformed soldiers, back to the relative safety of Washington, D.C. And Bull Run, the Battle of Bull Run, was a major shock to the system in the North. I mean, it was a really stunning reversal of expectations. And of course, contrary, you know, it's all one thing to say, you know, one big battle is going to determine the war. But when you lose that battle, of course, it simply becomes the first battle of a long campaign of attrition. And in response, essentially in response to Bull Run, the Lincoln administration puts in place a much more long-term plan to build up and train an army and appoints George McClellan to take charge of that process. McClellan then spends the rest of the year of 1861 and into the beginning of 1862 drilling and training his volunteers in preparation for what he then hopes and what the Lincoln administration then hopes will be the final decisive assault in the spring of 62.
This is what happens that makes Lincoln so impatient with McClellan, a theme that will go throughout the next year with his leadership, that he's just being too careful. At first, that seems like a good idea, because clearly this is more of a pitched battle than they thought. And so they're drilling and drilling. McClellan is drilling throughout the months leading into the fall of 1861. McClellan is drilling and drilling, and Lincoln wants to get going. And that's what leads us onward. I want to pause in one moment and talk about the huge issue of his conciliatory attitude toward the border states. This was a huge deal for Lincoln. Every one of his decisions was keeping those border states in the Union.
It was in those early months. And he was right to. I mean, he said, I'd like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky. Those four border slave states, so Kentucky, Missouri, Delaware, and Maryland, were for all kinds of reasons. It would have been really serious for the Union if those four slave states had seceded as well. I mean, not least, of course, it would have meant that Washington, D.C. would have been surrounded by seceded states. So through a combination of force and intimidation and conciliation, different strategies used in each of those four states, actually, conciliation especially applied to Kentucky, Lincoln was very, very keen to keep them on board for all kinds of reasons.
I'll be back with more American history after this short break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural materials, like leather made from plants, eucalyptus tree fiber, and sugarcane. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're super natural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.
We've already talked about his lack of experience in military deals, but now he's hiring real generals, McClellan being the first of a whole long line of them. Where does he get the opinions he has? Where has he learned his strategy? You know, what's he basing his positions on in these conversations with his generals?
Instinct and reading newspapers. He's not informed by military theory. But here's the key thing about Lincoln. His core perception and the key to his success as a commander-in-chief is that very early on in the war, what Lincoln understands is that the only way for the Union to win is for Confederate armies to be destroyed. That this is not a game of territory, that even taking the Confederate capital, Richmond, which of course, as it turns out, doesn't happen until the very dying days of the war in 1865, but even had Richmond fallen, as it could have done in an plausible alternative scenario in May of 1862, even had that happened, Lincoln understood in a way that most of his generals and newspaper editors on the home front in the North didn't understand. Even that would not in itself have ended the war, but the problem was armed insurgents. So the basic difference between Lincoln on the one hand and a succession of his generals in the Eastern Theater in Virginia was Lincoln always saying to them, go after General Lee's army, as it became after May 1862, go after the Army of Northern Virginia, the Confederate Army, whereas they were too often content to, as it were, push the Confederates back. They saw it as a game of territory. Lincoln saw it as a tussle between two big armies.
I've never understood that. What was their problem? I mean, it took years to get to Grant and to get to Lincoln's attitude being fought with. Those interim years, McClellan, Halleck, Hooker, all these guys, what was their deal? Were officers at West Point trained in this kind of careful warfare?
Yeah, part of the answer is yes, and part of the answer is certain. I mean, McClellan was very popular with his troops, and precisely because he was very careful with them. And, you know, Grant's success, on the other hand, was due to his willingness in the end to be blunt about it, to kind of feed men into a military machine. And the scale of casualties in the Eastern Theater when Grant finally took command in 1864 were beyond anything that anyone could ever have imagined in their worst nightmares back at the beginning of the war. So McClellan was fighting a very different kind of campaign. But here's the thing. I mean, McClellan, and to some extent those other generals that you mentioned, were trying to win what in modern terminology would be called a hearts and minds strategy. You know, they were trying to, on the one hand, use military force, but on the other hand, still to reassure Southerners that military defeat would not equate to total humiliating subjugation. That they could still, even once war had begun, even, you know, by the fall of 1862, they could still, should they so wish, re-enter the Union on, as it were, pretty much the terms on which they'd left it in 1861.
Which will become a theme, won't it? One can't forget that these are guys that have gone to school together not too long ago. These West Point grads, many of whom, including Robert E. Lee, you know, all of these guys had been cadets together in a unified nation just a few years before. That had to have played a role, at least in the planning and strategy that was going on. I can't help but draw a line between Lincoln's ignominious days fighting the Black Hawk War, which he really didn't fight, but understanding those indigenous warriors' tactics and therefore sort of projecting it onto the South. He sees a similarity, whereas the West Point guys are out there fighting the French War.
Yes, I think that's very true. I think that's very perceptive, Don. I agree.
I keep going back to this list, which I was just riveted by last night when I was studying this. The war changes dramatically after 1 year, obviously. On the eve of war, 1861, we had 16,400 men in uniform, the U.S. Army, 1.1 thousand officers. By April 1862, war 1 year old, the volunteer Union Army is 637,000. That's astonishing. I mean, that's a really amazing fact. That if I was the South at that point, I would have been, yep, okay, white flag.
Well, they can, you know, they were mobilizing their own population as well, and they needed to introduce conscription at a much earlier point than the North did.
Adam, I have a statistic for that.
Go for it, Don.
North, 2.1 million enlistees, the South, 1.1 million, roughly doubled by the North. I mean, it's incredible.
Even so, look at battles in the Eastern Theater. It's not really until you get to, well, let's say, you know, arguably maybe at Gettysburg in July 1863, but really not until 1864, that the disparity of size between the armies becomes a decisive factor. And so up until then, even when General Lee's army had been facing larger forces, they nevertheless managed to, as it were, equalize the playing field through clever tactics, moving quickly, dividing their forces in the face of the enemy, famously as at Chancellorsville, for example. So, the story of the war, in a sentence, as it were, is in the end, the North was always going to win so long as they could mobilize their massive advantages of men and material, which you've just listed there, Don. And the question was, would they be able to keep on going for long enough to bring to bear that advantage? And in the end, they were. But there are other scenarios would have been possible in which the war had ended first.
Adam, one of the huge issues overriding this is the issue of slavery and how this is handled throughout those early days of the war. Let's even talk about it before the Emancipation Proclamation, which, interestingly, I've learned in other episodes, is more of a military decision than I gave it credit for or understood it to be. It's really part of the strategy, isn't it?
Oh, it completely is part of the strategy. So, I mean, the story here is that enslaved people recognized in a way that most white Americans, North and South, refused to recognize. Enslaved people recognized from the beginning that military conflict between the federal government and seceded slaveholding states was an opportunity for revolution, for emancipation. And therefore, wherever there was an opportunity to do so, enslaved people went to Union lines and, as it were, sought refuge. So there was a big refugee population within the South. And this happened right from the start of the war. And so then the question was, how did Union commanders, individual Union commanders in particular places, respond? And some of them, who were in some cases slaveholders themselves or were completely unsympathetic to the anti-slavery movement, returned enslaved people, extraordinary as it may seem to us, returned enslaved people, refused to admit them behind Union lines and returned them to their enslavers. Others, however, sought much more creative solutions. And the most interesting and consequential was the solution adopted by Benjamin Butler, who, by the way, was a pre-war Democrat, a Breckinridge Democrat, so on what we sometimes think of as the pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. And Benjamin Butler used the term contraband to describe enslaved people who reached his lines at Fortress Monroe, which was a sort of Union enclave in Virginia. Now, this is a very clever use of the term, because essentially what Butler was saying was that enslaved people should be treated in the same way that armies would treat cannon or horses or any other object that could be used to wage war against them. So these refugee people should be held by us within Union lines and ideally put to work for us, digging entrenchments or whatever, against these rebels. And that was a kind of neat resolution, as it were, of the legal question of the standing of enslaved people at that time. Lincoln recognized at a fairly early stage, certainly by the spring of 1862 and after the failure of McClellan's Peninsula campaign, which was clear by June of 1862, Lincoln recognized that this was going to be a long war and that a long war required a frontal assault on slavery. Slavery was, to use the term that was often used by Northerners at the time, including Lincoln, was the taproot of the rebellion. So therefore, logically, if you wanted to destroy the rebellion, you had to destroy the thing that fed it, its taproot, and that was slavery. So as you say, Don, the emancipation, the military emancipation policy was always and only ever explained and justified by Abraham Lincoln as a military measure. If we want to end this war, we have to destroy the thing that is feeding this nasty rebellion. And therefore, why would we not take their enslaved peoples away from them and give them a bridge to come to us, and then eventually, by 1863, arm them, enslaved men, formerly enslaved men, in our army to use them against them? And of course, 200,000 African-American people fought for the Union in the end.
But interestingly, that is why we celebrate the 13th and 14th Amendments much more than the Emancipation Proclamation. There's a lot of cloudiness to do with the Emancipation Proclamation.
Its legal status was very questionable. It was at best legally justifiable only as a war measure. And so what Lincoln recognized was that should the war end, then there was no reason why people freed by the Emancipation Proclamation should have their legal status as free people respected by courts in a post-war settlement. And that was why he, Lincoln, was so keen that the 13th Amendment be passed before formal hostilities against the rebels ended.
It's fitting that Lincoln is a lawyer, probably more than he was a soldier, because there's all sorts of legalities that have to be worked out. A big headline is the Lieber Code, which comes into play in April of 1863. Can we discuss this at some length here? Because it's a very interesting thing which needs to be worked out. First of all, it really hinges on the fact that this is an insurrection more than the fight by a sovereign nation, right?
The Lieber Code was hugely consequential for later wars and the formation of international law around military conflict. What it did, and I think this is what you're saying, Don, is it stepped into the breach. I mean, I said at the beginning, I mean, you asked me how Lincoln understood secession, and I said he simply rejected its legality, which is true. But therefore, that left a kind of a real ambiguity here. You know, what were the, if this wasn't war, as it wasn't in Lincoln's, in the administration's mind, if this wasn't war between two sovereign nations, then what was it? And what, if anything, would restrain by what rules of conduct, what humanitarian factors needed to be borne in mind by Union generals? How would negotiations over exchanges of prisoners of war, for example, be conducted? And the Liber Code sought to answer some of those questions. So it concerned what did martial law mean? In what circumstances could it be introduced? What did the military have jurisdiction over and what did they not? How would you treat irregular fighters, guerrillas, differently from those who were in formal uniform? How would you treat deserters and spies? It defined, as it were, what was militarily necessary. So the concept of military necessity was defined in the Liber Code, but did it in a way that said military necessity does not admit of cruelty, that is, the infliction of suffering for the sake of suffering or for revenge, nor of maiming or wounding except in fight, nor of torture to extort confessions. So these were really important legal principles, which remained in the United States, but more broadly through the Hague Conventions much later on. So that's one of the reasons why the Liber Code was significant. It was written by a German emigre to the United States, Francis Lieber, who was an important and influential intellectual in the pre-war period, and in fact had lived in the South before the war. And so had quite a unique perspective as a lawyer, also experienced and witnessed warfare in Europe as well.
Yeah, it's one of the lasting legacies of the Civil War, really, is internationally. I mean, it really goes on to the Hague Convention. I guess the Geneva Code has something to do with it as well. The idea of codifying the legalities behind law really starts with the American Civil War, which is amazing.
Right.
Lincoln becomes, obviously, much, much more involved in the strategy and the fighting of the war as it goes along. One of the aspects of this that was his own visiting the front lines, which had obviously never happened before for an American president, short of George Washington fighting the war, it was highly irregular for this sort of thing to happen for a head of state. But off he goes several different times, early and in midpoint, later on too. How much does this speak of his impatience with his generals, or was he enjoying it? I mean, what was the factor of his involvement?
I think he wanted to see the troops. The war and the casualties of war and the death toll weighed very, very, very heavily on Lincoln. He saw himself, as coming from the common people. He had come from the common people. He liked to take in the White House what he called his public opinion baths, when he would kind of allow members of the public to come traipsing through his office and talk to them. And so when he visited the front, that's what he did. He talked to ordinary soldiers. He, of course, talked to his generals, but he also talked to ordinary soldiers. He wanted to understand the war as they were experiencing it.
It was also a way of him avoiding the business of Washington, wasn't it? For him to get out of town. I mean, can you imagine what that must have been like? You can't just leave Washington easily in those days.
That's right. And I mean, Washington was a crowded, noisy, and sickly city. And one of Lincoln's own sons died during the war. And so I think there certainly was a sense in which, Lincoln relished the opportunity to leave Washington even for periods.
The end of the war is ushered in by the new relationship between Ulysses S. Grant and President Lincoln. It's a relationship that I've never understood. I mean, I understand the fact of total war, and finally he has a general who's going to fight the war that he wished many had before him. But I don't know what these men saw in each other. It must have been commented on a lot.
They didn't really have a deep personal connection, right? I mean, it wasn't that there was any kind of history between them. In many ways, they weren't really very similar personalities. In fact, Lincoln was a teetotaler. Grant was definitely not. They had different attitudes about all kinds of things. I think it was simply that Grant was someone who, as Lincoln saw it, I mean, Grant fought. Grant is a general who fights. I can't spare this man, he said. And he saw that. I mean, Grant made his reputation in the Western theater, where Union arms were much more successful much earlier. The great problem for the Union was breaking through in the East, was breaking through in the Virginia theater, where, of course, General Lee was operating, and Lee had developed until Gettysburg in July 1863 this reputation for being utterly invincible. And Lincoln spotted in Grant a kind of gritty, steely determination. He saw it correctly in Sherman as well, of course, who'd operated very closely with Grant in the West. But Lincoln saw in those generals, and Grant in particular, that kind of steely determination to destroy rebel armies, which he had not found, as we've previously discussed in some of the earlier generals who he had appointed in the Eastern Theater.
There's so much we haven't discussed, and I want to remind listeners that there are other episodes of this podcast series to go to listen to. Robert E. Lee, for example, we've covered him. There is The Origins of Civil War with Adam Smith here. There are a number of them to look around at. What we have not discussed is the Appomattox surrender and the effect that that time had on the end of the war, the fact that the president dies a week after the surrender. Take me out of the Civil War, Adam.
So the manner of the war ending was hugely important. So Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in April 1865 was important, not just for the fact of it, but for the way in which it was done. So famously, you know, Lee had dressed up in his formal dress uniform, whereas General Grant had not. And General Grant was magnanimous to Lee and allowed his officers to retain their sidearms and their horses. And Lee, in his final message to the Army of Northern Virginia, thanked his men for their service and essentially told them to go back home and be loyal citizens of the United States. In the end, he said, "We have been defeated by overwhelming men and resources." You know, he's coming close to saying, "We never had a chance in this war." And that seems to form an optimistic basis for a post-war settlement. But then what happens is that Lincoln is assassinated just a week later. And that, of course, changes the political dynamic quite substantially. It brings into office Andrew Johnson, who's a very different kind of character, and very different sort of politics and background and identity from Lincoln. But it, as you can imagine, intensifies emotions on both sides. Lincoln is seen by Northerners as being a martyr for the cause of the Union. And it unquestionably intensifies the determination of Republicans in Congress, who constitute a large majority in Congress in 1865-66, to ensure the South, the white South, is held in a position where they have no thought of the possibility of resurrecting armed conflict. Because that was a reasonable question to have. You know, nobody knew in April 1865 that this was definitively the end of the war. The surrender of Lee looked like it was definitely the end of the war, and Lee had become so much the embodiment of the Confederate cause that for him to ceremonially surrender to Grant at Appomattox felt like the end of the war to almost everybody. But then Lincoln was assassinated, and shortly thereafter, Southern states passed what they call black codes, which looked to many people as if they were reinstantiating slavery by other means. And all of a sudden, this kind of gnawing anxiety crept across the North during the summer and fall of 1865 that maybe this was not, in fact, the end.
It takes away the chance for a peace with magnanimity. And that was the big deal. The huge counterfactual is, you know, what if Lincoln had lived and was able to apply his eloquent abilities to the situation, to make the speeches, to tour the country, to bring the South back in with the poetry that he was capable of doing. As a result of his death, we're left with Andrew Jackson, anything but a poet. It's a tragic ending to a huge tragedy in America. We are still living with the legacy of that assassination, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, historians think all the time through counterfactuals, whether or not they're conscious of it or not. We're always thinking about the path not taken, and it's something that interests me a great deal about all kinds of history I do. And this one is, as you say, one of the great ones. You know, I don't know whether, I mean, it's a lovely idea that you presented there of Lincoln's poetry kind of bringing the South back into the Union. But I mean, of course, I mean, Lincoln was hated. I mean, Lincoln was hated within the North by at least half the population before his assassination. I mean, one of the things, of course, is that being assassinated, you know, does tremendously positive things for your reputation, right? You know, and so people who, you know, were absolutely loathed him in life, retrospectively decide that they thought he was the savior of the Union. I mean, if Lincoln had lived, things would unquestionably have been different, if only just because he was a vastly more adept politician than Andrew Johnson. He wasn't so antagonistic. He had a much, much better, stronger working relationship with the Republican Party, with the Republican majority in Congress. And his instincts would always have been to, you know, move pragmatically and find ways of working with any groups within the South who wanted to work with him, as he had already done during the war in his reconstruction planning in Louisiana and Arkansas and other places. So I think unquestionably things would have been different. I mean, you know, actually, ironically, though, what may have been the consequence was that you would have had less radical Reconstruction legislation. Because what Congress did in, you know, the passage of the 14th Amendment in 1866 through Congress was it was a reaction to the Reconstruction Acts and then the 14th Amendment in 1866-67 was a reaction by Congress to the intransigence and apparent sympathy for defeated white Southerners of President Andrew Johnson. So you wouldn't have had that with Lincoln. So you might then not have had the radical reaction in Congress. So, I mean, obviously, we don't know, and we can only speculate that the process might have been smoother. But I mean, one way or another, you know, the defeated white South was not going to acknowledge some kind of sort of biracial society in any way in the 1860s. So by whatever route, there would have been white Southern resistance to any attempt by Congress in the 1860s, whoever was president, to define citizenship, as of course they did through the 14th Amendment, in a way that included formerly enslaved people.
Sure. And they certainly wouldn't have gotten away with lost cause mythology, which really shaped this country for 50 years. Adam, what's coming up next for you? What's your next book?
Well, I've got a book coming out about why Gettysburg matters, why Gettysburg is the Battle of the Civil War that, if you've heard of one, that's the one you've heard of, and how it's shaped American history over the last 150 years.
And I know you have a podcast series as well.
I do, Don. Yes, it's called The Last Best Hope. So I invite listeners to check it out wherever they get their podcasts. It's a podcast series that asks what makes America distinctive and thinks about the present through the lens of the past. The Last Best Hope.
Thank you, Adam Smith.
My pleasure, Don.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of American History Hit. Please remember to like, review, and subscribe. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of American History Hit. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you'll also get your first 3 months for just $1 a month when you use code AmericanHistory at checkout.